Thank you very much. Good morning. Good morning. Welcome to the California Coastal Commission. Let me just get my glasses on here. Could we have the roll call, please?
Commissioner Amenzada.
Here.
Commissioner Baker.
Here.
Commissioner Brownsey.
Present.
Commissioner Groom.
Present.
Commissioner Howell.
Here.
Commissioner Ketchum.
Here.
Commissioner Luevano.
Here.
Commissioner Padilla.
Present.
Commissioner Peskin.
Present.
Commissioner Sundberg.
Here.
Chair Bochco.
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you. So the agenda changes.
Good morning, Chair Bochco and commissioners, and to the public in the audience today.
I think your mic's on.
Yeah, I don't think my mic's on. Hello? Is it on? Yeah. Testing. Let's try that once again.
Yeah.
Testing?
Much
okay,
better.
Yeah. Work? Sounds like it. All right. Good morning, Chair Bochco. I'm sorry? Let's try that once again. Okay. If you do intend to speak to the commission today, please go ahead and fill out a speaker slip and submit that to staff at the entry to this room. And also, if you do have a cell phone, please make sure that you turn that on silence so that you don't disturb the meeting. As far as agenda changes this morning,
good timing.
All right, continuing with the agenda changes. Item 10A, which is revised City of Newport Beach post-LCP certification permit and appeal jurisdiction map, that matter's postponed. Item 11A, this is appeal A5 LGB 1815 Tenenbaum out of Laguna Beach, that matter's postponed. I'm sorry? Pardon me, yes, that was 11B. Again, that was 11B, appeal A5-1815, Tenenbaum, that's postponed. 15A, which is City of Carlsbad LCP amendment on prohibited uses, that's postponed. And item 17A, which is the San Diego County Airport Authority Terminal 2 expansion, that matter is postponed. And also item 6A, the legislative report from Wednesday's agenda, will be provided by Sarah Christie this morning after the public comment period is closed. And that concludes the agenda changes.
And the legislative report is right after public comment?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Is this working? You can hear me? Can you hear me? Is it all right? Okay, thanks. Okay, so we'll start with public comment. I have two speaker slips here. I'll start with Gina Zari.
Morning, Chair Bochco, commissioners. Good morning. Thank you for entertaining public comment. I'm here from San Mateo County Association of Realtors, and I wanted to briefly discuss the residential adaptation policy guidance. We know that planning for the future is critical, so we appreciate your efforts to plan and look forward for our industry. Land use planning is critical. But we have a couple of suggestions we'd like to make with respect to the residential adaptation policy guidance. Wisely, the residential adaptation policy guidance calls, I think we counted 15 times, for maximum public input. And that's critical, and that's absolutely important. So far, there's been relatively little public input. A couple of webinars and two comment periods, I think one of which received 27 comments, is not maximum public input in a state the size of ours. So we would ask that there's a great deal more public input before this document is finalized. As a suggestion, we request that you would entertain doing a mailing to all of the residents within the jurisdiction of the Coastal Commission so that they understand the consequences potentially to their homes and to their property values and to the restrictions that might encounter in the future. We would also kind of make the point that the realtors are hundreds of thousands of realtors in California, and realtors are the ones that are on the front lines dealing with individuals as they, you know, are going to be figuring out how to handle the restrictions on their property that's set forth in the residential adaptation policy guidance. And so it's really important to us that they have an understanding of what's taking place prior to the finalization. We would also ask that that the other two pieces, the commercial piece and the public works piece, are also completed and kind of viewed as a whole package prior to finalization of the residential adaptation policy guidance. As anyone who's worked in land use knows, you can't separate commercial, residential, and public use. They're inextricably intertwined, and so that's a critical piece. Once that's finished, we're hoping that you will take those three pieces, residential, adaptation, commercial, and public works, and send it down to the local jurisdictions and ask that they review it. Our suggestion and our request is that you ask that local cities hold a minimum of two public hearings with public comment so that people can understand what's taking place and what's going to happen to their homes. As you know, it's inevitable, but it's really important that we handle this properly. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Groom has a comment.
Thank you. I just want to let all of you know that the Board of Realtors called me and talked about this issue, and Jack and Madeline were kind enough to for Madeline to come to San Mateo County. We spent several hours with the realtors. Many of these suggestions Madeline said that she would take back and meet with the staff and see if we could do some of that implementation.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would also just comment on the residential guidelines. You know, we've extended out our public comment period multiple times now in order to maximize our public input on this. And, you know, we will be rolling out public hearings on this. We may have multiple public hearings like we've done with the tribal consultation policy, maybe one in Southern California, maybe one in Northern California, to make sure we're covering getting as much input as we can on this. But it's important to remember what these are. These are guidelines. The real heavy lift comes when we start working with our local governments on their local coastal programs and updating. That's where the public input really comes in for that local area, because context matters, as we've always said, and it's you know, drilling in to on each local jurisdiction to figure out what the appropriate adaptation strategies are going to be for that jurisdiction. So it's important to keep in mind what these are. These are not regulations. These are guidelines in order to help our local governments, provide them some guidance and sample policy language that they can riff off of to have the best LCP adaptation strategies in their LCP. So we are committed to that public process. So thank you. And one other thing. We have, as I said yesterday, we have 45 LCP grants out there now. The planning is occurring, so our local government partners are hungry for some guidance and some suggestions, and it's important that we get that out just as soon as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think that was pretty evident yesterday with the Santa Barbara situation. It's one of those things where we have to look at each county individually and go from there. All right. Dale Dunn.
Good morning. My name is Dale Dunn, and I am an individual property owner that drove here from Half Moon Bay to speak to you about my concerns with some of the guidelines that have been presented. My husband and I stood before a coastal commission in the early 90s to present a building on Murata Road, 7,500 square foot mixed-use commercial residential art gallery. And the county planner had denied the plans and said, you need to take it to the commission. We brought it to the commission. We did our due diligence, and you all approved it 5-0. The very successful building added to the value of the community. We did a lot of individual things that most commercial enterprises don't do. We had children's readings, events, music, all for free to the public because it is a special place. We fell in love with it, and we wanted to make a contribution to the longevity of our coastline and our economy. When I was invited to take a look at these guidelines, I was concerned because I'm intimately involved with two buildings on the coast side. One is that I am the director of finance for Sam's Chatterhouse, and our location is in the harbor on a bit of a bluff, and that building would be treated not unlike the Ritz-Carlton, which is on an exposed bluff. And I don't see that there is an integration or a combination. I'm going to reinforce Gina's comments about how critically important it is to develop residential along with commercial, along with public works. We could not have been successful in doing our building without all three of those side by side. And it's very difficult to go through and say, I support this without knowing how the other elements would be treated. So I encourage you to take seriously the comments about developing those three categories all at the same time, making sure that we have enough time for public comment, and to recognize that there are a lot of individuals out there who are going to be impacted. My building is going to be one of them. Sam's Chatterhouse is going to be one of them. I can see what's happened with, and I'm not talking about rising sea level, I'm just talking about, you know, just what the ocean does by itself, taking a look at our riprap, the protection that is in place for the building that we have. And I know that there is some resistance to doing that kind of thing for property owners, but if you take a look at what's happened on Murata Road, on either end of our protection, there is significant erosion. And so Public Works had a big part in making sure that our property rights were protected, and I want to ensure that as you move forward, you consider that in your guidelines. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I have no other speaker slips, so I'll bring it back to staff.
Good morning, Chair and Commissioners. This month's ledge report is going to be a little bit different this morning. The Commission is very fortunate to have UC Public Interest Law Fellow Sean Drake working out of our Sacramento office this year. Sean is a recent UC Davis Law grad. He's been working with the ledge unit since last October. He's actually prepared the three analyses for the three bills before you today for positions, so he'll be presenting those today. We're very pleased to have Sean with us. I did want to mention he's also done two voluntary internships with our enforcement division before choosing to spend his fellowship with the commission, so we're very grateful to Sean. But before he gets started, I wanted to give you some status updates on some of the priority bills that we discussed last month. So the first is AB 1196 by Assemblymember Harper. That's the bill that would have allowed the city of Newport Beach to become a port for the purposes of the... Is this on? 1196 would have allowed the city of Newport Beach to become a port for the purposes of the Coastal Act, thereby allowing it to prepare a port master plan. The commission did take a position to oppose that bill last month, and as a result, the author asked the Natural Resources Committee to not set that bill for hearing. The deadline has since passed, and so that bill won't be moving forward. The second bill is AB 2754 by Assemblymember Levine. That's the bill that would have amended the Coastal Act definition of development to include a long list of agricultural activities that would no longer be subject to coastal development permits as we are accustomed to them. Again, the commission did vote unanimously to oppose that bill, and upon learning of the commission's official position on that, Assemblymember Levine withdrew the bill from the hearing that was agendized the following week. So that bill will not be moving forward this year either. The third is AB 2797. And Billy, we have some language on that for the screen, I believe. AB 2797 by Assemblymember Bloom was the bill that would have amended the government code section that currently clarifies the relationship between the Coastal Act and the density bonus law. That this bill has been introduced in response to an appellate court decision, Colonel Gardens versus the City of Los Angeles. As originally introduced, that bill would have made the scenic and visual resources policies of the Coastal Act no longer apply to density bonus projects. That obviously raised concerns, so Coastal staff worked with both the author and the sponsor on an amendment to that bill that we discussed with the commission last month. There were some concerns about the amendment that we had negotiated. It did eliminate the reference to 30251 and sought to seek a better balance between the implementation of those two laws. But the commission shared the concerns of members of the public with that and asked staff to go back to the drawing board, which we did, and we've since negotiated the following. I apologize, the italics don't show up very italic-y with this font. So just to clarify, the top section, that's the operative section in the government code. The first sentence of that is existing law that's been in the government code for 16 years. So what the bill does is add the next section, the next sentence, which is slightly in italics, to specify that any density bonus or other concessions and incentives that are incorporated into a density bonus project shall be permitted in a manner that is consistent with the Coastal Act, essentially, which was the entire point of that section to begin with. Because density bonus law provides for some streamlined review and some by right entitlements to certain types of density bonus incentives that happen outside the scrutiny of an LCP. And so when that code section took effect, this code section took effect alongside it to say, okay, we're going to streamline the processing, we're not going to require an LCP amendment for them, but those projects still need to comply with the Coastal Act. That's not a get-out-of-jail-free card for the Coastal Act. And so this amendment sort of doubles down on that statement. The next section is the legislative findings that speaks to the reason why the legislature is amending that code section. And again, it just seeks to address the holding in Colonel Gardens. The previous amendment had talked about superseding the dicta. That language is gone. And the members of the public who were concerned about this and the bill sponsors and the author's office and the Coastal Commission are all happy with this language. And it did get out of Natural Resources Committee unanimously last week.
I'm sorry, can I just interrupt for a second?
Yes.
You're talking about the legislative intent language here that I'm looking at my sheet, which
yes.
I'm sure that's the same thing up there, right?
Yes.
It still contains the legislature's intent is the two statutes be harmonized.
Yes.
So it is, Chief, I still find that language impossible to really interpret, and lawyers are just going to have a field day with harmonizing.
Well, I'm going to let Chris Peterson handle that one.
Okay. He's a lawyer.
Harmonize is a broad term, but it's a term that's used in many court decisions where courts will routinely say that if there are two state statutes that apply in a particular situation, the goal is normally to apply both of them, to harmonize them so you can accomplish both of those statutes. So that's generally the starting assumption for the courts is to try to apply any applicable state statutes that apply. If there's a conflict, then they try to resolve, okay, was there a legislative intent for one statute to supersede another?
I'm assuming there'll be conflict. There are always conflicts between statutes. Well, not always, but there certainly are a lot. And so
it seems to me that if the affordable housing statute is in conflict with the Coastal Act, it should be very clear that when you harmonize it, it means you cannot prioritize the other statute over the Coastal Act.
We believe this does that. The language of the amendment that you saw last month, the word harmonize was actually in the operative language of 65915M. And so that's no longer there.
Right.
To our read, that section is still clear that if you are going to take advantage of the density bonus incentives and concessions, that those can only take place provided the overall project is still consistent with the Coastal Act.
I'd love to hear that language.
Well, that's
do you think that really says that?
That's a statute language you see in that first paragraph.
And the first one, see, I don't see it. It's consistent with this section and. Okay. I'm going to have Commissioner Brownsey talk to you because she knows much more about this.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but I do know something about how legislation works. And so, Chair Bochco, what may give you some comfort is the legislative findings are not codified. They're just simply legislative intent. Okay. The law that is being changed, so the where the court must direct its attention is to that second sentence, which says any bonus, concession, incentive, waiver, or reduction shall be permitted in a manner that consistent with, so it has to comply with the Coastal Act. So I think the legislative findings is just a way to, you know, kind of signal that there's a reason why this second semi-redundant sentence was added, but it's not codified. It's just there to provide some background if the court seeks it.
Okay. And again, I would only say I'm not clear under this any of this language, what happens if there's a conflict? Who wins?
If it's not consistent.
You know, we have our own balance
here
that we can
do. If it's not consistent with the Coastal Act, it can't be approved. And the bill sponsors are clear with that. I mean,
great.
We spoke with them many, many times, and they said, we're absolutely fine with a project being denied at the end of the day if it's built on a wetland or it's blocking public access, or we're right. Not saying that every density bonus project in the coastal zone should be approved. They're just concerned that the holdings in Colnell would have allowed a local government to deny a project simply based on its density.
I see.
So that's
okay. Well, thank you. Thanks a lot.
That's what we addressed. So.
Appreciate it.
And then the last bill, SB 827, the commission didn't have a position on it, but you did have some discussion on it last month. That's the bill by Senator Weiner that addresses transit-rich housing that would have significantly increased the potential for building denser, taller residential buildings along transit corridors as defined in the bill. It was a fairly broad definition. That bill had been getting quite a lot of statewide publicity, and a lot of commissioners had been hearing about it in their local communities. That bill was heard in the Senate Transportation and Housing Committee 2 weeks ago. It did not receive the votes to move out of committee. The author did ask for and receive reconsideration, so, you know, technically it could still be on the table, but that bill was held in its first policy committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's not going away, though, because I heard all of the press surrounding that piece of legislation was that the author is absolutely committed to pursuing this, that something must be done. So, I mean, I think this is an issue that is going to continue to have a lot of attention for the near future, at least.
We would agree. So unless there are any questions about any other bills in the ledge report, I'm going to hand it over to Sean for your three positions today.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Commissioners. Today we'll be presenting three bills that are making their way through the legislature. Those are AB 1884 by Assemblymember Calderon, AB 2379 by Assemblymember Bloom, and AB 2779 by Assemblymember Stone. You'll notice that these three bills have a common goal, and that is to reduce the amount of plastic pollution in the marine environment. Plastic pollution is certainly a worldwide problem that particularly damages marine and coastal habitats. When a piece of plastic is littered, it doesn't biodegrade like a natural material. It remains in the environment indefinitely. In the ocean, littered plastics break into smaller and smaller pieces. These plastic fragments, known as microplastics, infiltrate the marine ecosystem by leaching chemicals into the water column and being ingested by marine and pelagic wildlife at every level of the food chain, from plankton to fish, birds, turtles, and even whales. We've all seen the photos of dead seabirds with stomachs that are just bursting full of pieces of small plastic. When fish and shellfish are caught and sold for human consumption, these plastics inside those creatures enter the human diet. A 2015 study out of UC Davis sampled 76 samples of 12 species of fish and shellfish at a local California fish market and found plastic debris in 25% of them. So you can see plastic pollution is not only a pervasive environmental problem, it is also potentially a human health problem. When littered plastic washes up on the beach, it harms coastal economies and leads to inequitable public enjoyment of the coast. A 2013 report prepared for the Natural Resources Defense Council concluded that Californians shoulder over $400 million annually trying to prevent coastal litter that damages the environment, tourism, and other local economic activities. Another study from the NOAA Debris Program found that California residents spend millions of dollars each year avoiding littered local beaches in favor of cleaner beaches that are often farther away and costlier to reach. This finding raises environmental justice concerns as it correlates the ability to access clean, litter-free beaches with socioeconomic status and access to personal transportation. So collectively, the threat of plastic pollution, both to the environment and to ourselves, necessitates a societal shift in the way that we consume and dispose of plastic items. However, given that we are producing 300 million tons of plastic worldwide every year, that societal shift is naturally going to happen in incremental steps, where progress is made in a series of many separate pushes forward. The three bills today each represent one step toward that ultimate goal, which is eradicating plastic pollution from the marine and coastal environment. The first bill today, Assembly Bill 1884 by Assemblymember Calderon, seeks to reduce plastic pollution by limiting consumption of single-use plastic straws at restaurants. Specifically, what this bill would do is prohibit sit-down, dine-in restaurants, the kind where you're being served at a table, from distributing plastic straws unless a straw is requested by a consumer. Any violating restaurant would be fined $25 for each day that it is in violation. To be clear, this bill would not ban plastic straws. Rather, the idea is to shift the default in restaurants from what it is now, where you sit down and everyone gets a straw with their drink, to instead giving a straw only when the consumer actually requests one. Staff believes that this simple shift in practice would raise awareness of the issue of plastic pollution, as well as reduce the number of straws that find their way to the coast. Thanks to the Commission's leadership with California Coastal Cleanup Day, staff has comprehensive data on the types and amounts of items that litter our coastline, and single-use plastic straws are the sixth most commonly littered item. Coastal Cleanup Day volunteers alone have picked up more than 827,000 littered straws from California's beaches since 1988. This bill would reduce the number of plastic straws used at sit-down dine-in restaurants, and by doing so, it would reduce the number of littered straws that enter the marine environment. Last October, this commission unanimously adopted a resolution recognizing the month of November as No Straw November as part of a nationwide grassroots effort to raise public awareness and empower consumers to personally reduce plastic straw use. AB 1884 shares this objective and goes a step further by prohibiting all sit-down restaurants from providing a straw unless the consumer requests one. This straws upon request policy, as it's called, will further decrease the number of straws consumed and consequently the number entering the waste stream and the marine environment. I did want to note for you, as you can see on the legislative report, staff has recommended a support position for this bill. However, before turning it over for commission discussion, I want to briefly elaborate on that position. The analysis that you have before you and the staff recommendation and support were based on the version of the bill as amended April 16th. However, the bill was amended again on April 30th. In short, what those amendments did was place a cap on the amount of fines that can be levied against a violating restaurant at $300 per year. This cap does create the concern that with the cap being so low, some restaurants may distribute straws the same as always and simply consider a $300 annual fine the cost of doing business. In addition to that concern, the bill may also occupy the field, possibly deterring future stronger legislation because this measure would already be in place. Having said that, staff's recommendation remains support, but we certainly wanted to bring those concerns to the Commission's attention before you consider adopting an official position.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Yamazata.
Yeah, thank you so much to staff. I just want to say that I think it's important for us to consider what message we're sending if we adopt a position. And I think we want to send a message of support generally for these source reduction bills and for straws in particular. But I am concerned that both the cap on fines, which are de minimis over the course of a year and would encourage business as usual, I think, for most entities, as well as the exception for takeout, I would suggest something more moderate, such as a support if amended position. I think we want to relay our support for the author's leadership and for this general body of legislation. But at the same time, I think we want to be sure that when we're putting effort into these types of reforms, that they're true reforms and not half measures. It took us 8 years to pass the plastic bag ban, so we know that, you know, we can't easily come back, and that the degree of progress that we make is important, and it will result in less straws or more straws on our beaches. And so I would just urge the Commission to consider a supportive amended position.
Commissioner Brownsey.
I would second that recommendation for the reasons stated so clearly by Commissioner Amezada. It's, to me, the people sitting in a restaurant eating their lunch, sipping their Diet Coke, are not the straws that end up on the beach. When we were in Dana Point last month, or whenever it was, I walked the beach every morning, and parts of the beach were littered with takeout containers, drinks as well as food containers, straws, plastic bags, disposable diapers, that kind of stuff. You know, so to me, I think, yes, it is an important statement, but I also think that the support with amended position would convey, you know, what the reality is in terms of the plastic waste and how it gets to the beach. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Anybody else? 'Cause I actually had a thought, which is there are alternatives to plastic straws. There are paper straws. I mean, when I was a kid, that's all you had, even flavored paper straws. Is there a way perhaps to be more encouraging rather than call it a penalty or something that if a restaurant, takeout or otherwise, wants to use paper straws that maybe they would get some kind of benefit, you know, whether it's a little tiny tax deduction or, you know, whatever. You guys are much better at that than me. But it just, it gives me the idea because a lot of times I remember when we all were fighting the plastic bags, we wanted to get rid of them. And you listen to the grocers and the local people who felt like, oh, this is going to cost me a lot of money and I'm not going to be able to have a bag. There were always alternatives. So maybe there's a more positive way to approach encouraging people to use non-plastic straws.
Well, let me just start by saying staff's fine with taking a supportive amended position there. We definitely see the wisdom of that. If we do take a supportive amended position, it would be helpful if staff had a little more clarification of what amendments the commission would like to see. Are you just going after the $300 cap? Would you just like to see that removed, or would you support the bill at that stage, or would you like it to go all the way to the stage of including takeout containers? What are the amendments that you're
seeking? When I made the, I didn't make an official motion, but I was intending for both those items you just mentioned, not only the cap, but also the takeout exemption. And I just think, I think it could be just helpful to sort of encourage legislative leadership on that. I know they face an immense amount of pushback and lobbying from industry. And so if we can really communicate the importance of, you know, being strong. I think the alternatives option is a good one and also could be contemplated and integrated into the existing bill, because if they're doing straws upon request, I think it could also motivate businesses to offer other alternatives, to sell, you know, glass straws and other things. And that's something that we do see among restaurants who are stewards in this area. So I don't know that we'd want to make it a condition of the bill in particular, but it seems to be something that happens sort of naturally once we restrict the, or, you know, reverse the presumption of use of straws.
We could take that back to the author's office and get that conversation going as part of the mix going forward.
Okay.
So without without a specific parameter about what that approach would be, just kind of let that evolve.
And I think that makes a lot of sense. So do we need a motion on that?
Yeah, we do.
Commissioner Amezada?
I'd like to make a motion to take a position of support if amended on this bill, which is?
That is?
AB 1884.
AB 1884.
And the amendment would be to remove the cap, the annual cap on the fines, and to include takeout.
Correct.
Takeout food
as
well.
Okay. Thank you.
Unwillingness for unanimous. Yes, Commissioner Sundberg.
So is the idea that there would be, you could write off the straws at some point, is that, I liked your idea about having them be able to write off if they bought paper straws, for instance. I think that would do a lot more for encouragement, because it's thousands of restaurants. I'm sure that's not, they're going to, if there was a financial incentive built into it, I think it would be much more successful. Can we make that part of the motion?
Or does it I don't know, Sarah. Is that something you feel you can take back?
My sense is that that's sort of taking the bill in an inherently different direction. I'm perfectly happy to suggest that as a consideration for the author going forward. But I think it's a little... It feels like we're sort of making too much of an incursion into the realm of the legislator's discretion to start. That might be a good discussion to have for a bill next year, I think.
And I think once we put this restriction forward, it does encourage businesses to consider other types of straws, because the restriction is narrowly tailored on single-use plastic straws. Right. So I think the paper straws idea could occur. But I would agree, I think that's somewhat outside the scope of the legislation as contemplated, so it might be better for discussion purposes, but not like a suggested amendment.
Or again, a good idea for a bill next year.
And just another yes, I think these ideas are good, but it would add a fiscal cost to this bill, because there would be a loss of state revenue for a tax deduction. So it's a good idea to try to figure out incentivizing this, but I think that might take this bill in a place where it would
die
pretty much.
Thank you, Chair Bosco.
All right, is there any unwillingness for unanimous consent to the amended support if amended? We approve support if amended.
All right. Thank you. The second bill is Assembly Bill 2379 by Assemblymember Bloom. This bill addresses another source of marine plastic pollution, which is plastic microfibers from synthetic fabrics. Whenever you wash a piece of clothing, it sheds little fibers of the clothing material, which then drain away with the wash water. These fibers, known as microfibers, are too small to be caught in the filters of washing machines, and they also pass through the filters of most wastewater treatment plants. As a result, microfibers that are shed from clothing in the wash ultimately end up in the ocean. For natural clothing materials like cotton and hemp, that's not a problem because shed fibers naturally biodegrade in the marine environment. On the other hand, fibers from synthetic fabrics like polyester, nylon, spandex, are plastic-based. So like all plastics, they do not break down naturally in the ocean. Rather, fibers shed from synthetic fabrics remain in the marine environment where they are ingested or absorbed by marine organisms throughout the food web, from mollusks and crabs to fish, whales, and so on. When an animal ingests or absorbs these microfibers, toxins in the plastic can transfer to the animal's tissue and cause gut impaction, hormone disruption, and liver damage. That also raises an important question about human health consequences of consuming organisms and drinking water that contain synthetic microfibers. AB 2379 seeks to inform the public of the issue, specifically the fact that washing synthetic fabrics contributes to plastic pollution. To do so, this bill would require any garment made of more than half synthetic material to have a label stating that the garment sheds plastic microfibers when washed and that these microfibers contribute to marine plastic pollution. For pieces of clothing already required to have a washing instructions label under federal law, this language would go on that label too. Now, the idea of the bill is not to get people to stop washing their clothes. Rather, by putting the information on a visible label, consumers will be more informed at the point of sale. They'll also be more informed when they go to wash these clothing items and can use washing methods that minimize shedding, like hand washing, washing on delicate, things like that. By informing consumers of the consequences of synthetic microfibers, AB 2379 will encourage responsible consumer habits, a critical first step toward reducing the ubiquity of synthetic microfibers in the marine environment. For these reasons, staff is recommending a support position on Assembly Bill 2379.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner Amazzano, go for it.
Yes, I'd like to make a motion to support the bill as recommended. I will say, though, the labeling requirement does feel like a fairly incremental step, so it'd be great to sort of continue the discussion with the author and see how we can move the discussion forward a little more than that. It's a great educational and sort of dialogue-prompting bill, but I think we will need to go much further, and we can go much further.
We could certainly do that. This incremental step, as you imagined, was the author's preference for now, but that's certainly a conversation that can be had going forward.
I just have a question because just the way it's implemented in the state, since a lot of clothing comes from Europe or out of state, how do they label for our state? You know what I'm saying? So, for instance, it says washable fabric, what have you. Mm-hmm. How do they make sure that the California label,
if they're selling it to California,
right,
it needs to have the label in it.
Right.
If you want the California market, you got to put the label in it.
But basically, you know, you think about a department, and I'm not. I actually agree with this. Yeah. I would love to support it. I'm just thinking out loud that it's like, you know, if you get something from Prada or something that's from Italy, and it probably comes to this. I don't know if it's distributed the state or if it's distributed at department stores or what, but I'm sure they'll figure it out.
I think.
Madam Chair, thank you. I've worked on legislation like this when the state of California seeks to regulate what is really a global industry. And essentially, because California is such a huge market, what will happen is the manufacturers will put these labels on all the clothes because that is the easiest way to do it, which is just to add the label. And if this bill should pass in California, a number of coastal states would probably follow, which is a testament to, you know, the leadership of the California legislators who are thinking about these things, you know, Assemblymember Bloom in particular, really doing some fine work here. The other is that often, in global markets, I'm just going to use cosmetics as an example. The cosmetics industry, because in the United States and outside of the European Union, a number of toxic chemicals, reproductive toxins, carcinogens are not permitted to be part of the products in the EU. So the cosmetics manufacturers actually manufacture two separate lines of cosmetics, one's for the EU and one for everybody else. So, but efforts in California to require the listing of reproductive toxins and carcinogens on cosmetics was a huge battle. The bill was signed by Governor Schwarzenegger, and as a result, cosmetics companies started shifting so that they were producing more products without these ingredients, as they did in the European Union. So these global manufacturing and businesses have proven to figure out when the case is compelling enough, and certainly we would think that this would be one of those cases.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks. That's very encouraging.
We did also want to quickly note the original version of this bill was a little bit more complex in that it, one, included language about requiring or recommending hand washing of garments, and it also made distinctions that certain synthetic garments got this language, other synthetic garments got this language. And as the bill has been amended, that language has been kind of made uniform so that it's one set of language and it's going to appear more kind of broadly across all sorts of synthetic fabrics that are majority synthetic material.
And just a bill like this in and of itself, just like the discussion that we're having here today, I can say for myself, I had absolutely no consciousness of microfibers until this bill was introduced. And I'm really going to think twice about the fabrics of the clothes that I buy from now on. So labeling seems like, you know, it's not a big, bold step. But, you know, I've said so many times in Sacramento, you make the tiniest little shift in Sacramento, it can have such an enormous impact on the ground. And,
right.
and this is, I think this could
right.
be one of
yeah.
those instances.
I agree. Do I have a motion?
No, Mira.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mira.
Yeah, I was going to second it, but I also... Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to second Commissioner Amezada's motion, but also just wanted to add, again, the fact that this is so incremental is a little bit frustrating. And to your point, Sarah, in terms of purchasing anything, and in particular clothing, how many times do you read the label that carefully to figure out that this is a microfiber that is going to end up in the ocean? I mean, I would encourage you to encourage the author to push for a broader education mm-hmm. effort with this mm-hmm. issue. So I know we can't do all
sure.
that from here, but
right.
I'll second the motion.
Commissioner Amezada, did you make the motion? Okay. And the second, is there any unwillingness for unanimous consent? Seeing none, we approve supporting the bill.
All right. The final bill today is Assembly Bill 2779 by Assemblymember Stone. This bill also seeks to reduce plastic pollution, but in the form of littered bottle caps. It would do so by requiring that for any bottle or similar plastic container, 1 liter or smaller, the cap must be tethered or otherwise secured to the container. Like plastic straws, bottle caps are a commonly littered item that dirty our beaches and pollute marine ecosystems. According to the Commission's Coastal Cleanup Day data, plastic caps and lids are the third most collected piece of litter on California's beaches, with volunteers having collected over 1,800,000 caps and lids since 1988. By requiring bottle caps to be tethered to the bottle, this bill would help ensure that bottle caps are disposed of with the bottle. There is a robust market for recycling plastic bottle caps here in the United States. And while some recyclers were once unable to process plastic beverage containers with the caps, today the vast majority of recycling facilities accept containers with the cap on. The Association of Plastic Recyclers even encourages consumers to recycle containers with the cap on. Tethering bottle caps and lids to the container will increase the likelihood that they are disposed of responsibly and aren't ending up on California's beaches or in the stomachs of California's wildlife. For these reasons, staff is recommending a support position on Assembly Bill 2779.
Commissioner Amezada?
Yes, I'd like to make a motion that we support this.
Okay. Any more discussion by anyone? Okay, is there any unwillingness, unanimous yes, on supporting the bill? Seeing no objection, we support the bill.
Thank you, Commissioner.
now.
Madam Chair, I think we have some public speakers on this.
Yes, Jack.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He doesn't trust me.
I don't blame you. I don't trust me either. Don Schmitz.
I hated my mom and dad fight.
I know. Oh, we always make up.
Good morning, Commissioners. Don Schmitz on behalf of the City of Newport Beach. I wanted to speak to you briefly about Assembly Bill 1196. And after our fun hearing in front of you last month, I went down and I reported to the City Council in regards to your position of opposition. And they were disappointed. And they asked me if, well, what could be done about it? They asked me what the concerns were. I said staff felt like a couple things, that they were not properly in the loop in regards to this, and that's a fact. We moved quickly at the last minute to get within this legislative docket, and that the some of the commissioners had real concerns that Newport Beach wasn't an industrial port, and we never were asserting that it was, and that there was jurisdictional issues. And they asked, well, can we amend the bill, which was what they basically wanted to engage the commission on? Can we put specific language in there so that we recognize Newport Beach as a unique case, that it's not an industrial port, that it's a very large port that has a very long history, legislative history, so that there wouldn't be the precedent concerns that this commission expressed? I said yes, we could do that. And then they asked whether or not I thought that the commission and the staff would be supportive of that, and I reported to them no. My read was that the mood was overall not supportive of going in this direction. And they were very disappointed. They think that this is a good idea. And they asked about the alternative, which is, of course, the public works plan, and what that could and could not do, in my professional opinion. And I laid that out for them the best that I could. And I said that the public works plan did have a lot of advantages. It was better than nothing, but it hadn't been done for decades in the state of California. And we would really have to work closely with staff to see if this would be a viable option. There's a very important aspect to all of this that I want to report back to you, though, which is why I came here today. They could have proceeded with the bill. They have a lot of bipartisan support for it. But a number of the council members at that hearing expressed a very strong sentiment that they cherish the working relationship that this city has built with this commission and its staff over the last 10 years for some very difficult action items, the LCP, a number of parks. They want to maintain that. So in actuality, at that city council hearing, they voted to withdraw their sponsorship and communicated that to the author and the co-authors. And I know that Councilman Scott Piotr's here, who wants to have a follow-up in regards to my comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Councilman Piotr.
Commission Chair, thank you for letting me come before you again. It's only been a month, but as Mr. Schmitz pointed out, our council really does want to achieve our goals, and we want to do it in the best way possible. And it was never the intent of the council to force something over the commission through the Port Master Plan. We were just following what we thought was the best route to try and simplify and basically get good government. I think we both have a common goal, that we want to protect our coastal resources, including access and other things. And Newport Beach has a unique port, or a harbor. It is the largest recreational harbor in the United States. It has more private recreational boats in it than any other harbor. Therefore, we felt that what we wanted to do in simplifying it is to try to avoid a two-step, three-step process for private owners or the city in going through a lot of the major improvements that are really necessary in the port. The harbor is over 100 years old, and there's a lot of infrastructure that has been put in that is in the 60 to 70 year range. So we're anticipating, as we replaced a major bridge this last couple of years, that there's going to be a lot of major work needing to be done. Utility lines going underneath the harbor, bridges, dredging, again, I gave the example last time, I think, of the Golden Gate Bridge, where you start at one end, start painting it. By the time you're done with the other end needs painting again. We wanted to do the same kind of a philosophy in regards to dredging. It might be 10 years, not 2 years, but you have a continual ongoing dredging operation. And again, we felt that the way to make that happen best for our both the city and private residents was a port master plan, which of course would have to have been approved by you, but it would allow the permitting process to be simplified. If a dock owner right now wants to change his dock, he comes to us for a permit, then he has to come to you for a permit, and if he adds a single square foot, it comes to the commission. And we're just trying to simplify that. So I distributed a letter to you earlier today, which basically confirms a lot of the items that our council discussed before and that your staff had indicated as far as public works plan. We've got a little chart in the back that talks about, in a 30,000-foot type of a deal, public docks, private docks, dredging, utilities, some of the things I've already talked about, breakwaters. And I guess what I'm here today to ask you is that we'd like to get some kind of a plan together that we can work with staff. I'd love to have a high-level staff meeting with our staff and coastal staff, and as far as which instrument for which work we want to have done, kind of an overall scope document, and have them report back to you with the process and the procedure that we're going to take. I hope that is clear in what we want to do.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Jack. And Madam Chair, I would just say I appreciate the city's partnership on this moving forward and working together proactively to provide a more efficient government, which is, as you know, has been my goal, and I am very committed to that. It's not only efficient government, but leading to good outcomes, but also to protect our coastal resources. We have to remember that. So I appreciate the city's partnership in this, and of course we will work with them to create, going forward, a more efficient process. And that's what this public works plan was. That was the intent, was to create a more efficient permitting process. So that's the right vehicle to move forward with on this matter. Right. So we will.
Well, we appreciate the cooperation. It's very nice of you. So Susan Jordan is our last speaker on this item.
Not going down. Oh, there it goes.
It only likes Vinny.
I love it. I had to try it one more time because I know I'll never get to do it again. Okay, that's good. Thank you. Susan Jordan, Director of the California Coastal Protection Network. So I wanted to talk about AB 2797 in the language, and I just wanted to reassure you, we had some really good legal minds working on this. The sponsors were responsive, as was the author's office, and we do believe that it makes clear that any project, that affordable housing project that gets a density bonus must be consistent with the Act. The author was responsive as well. In response, we took away our opposition, and we gathered support from other partners, NRDC, Azul, Environment California, Sierra Club, Surfrider. Separately, RLF supported the bill, and Sierra Club was kind enough to go in and testify at the hearing to express our support, because we thought it was important to thank the author, because he does terrific work. We just felt that this was an unintended consequence, perhaps. So we all worked very well together, and I just wanted to assure you that I think we have accomplished what we set out to do. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so we move along to South Coast.
All right, that takes us to item five today, which is the administrative calendar for South Coast District, Orange County. There are five items, four routine docks in Newport Beach, and one routine cantilever deck in Huntington Beach. Conditions are acceptable to the applicant. There's no known opposition, so staff recommends the commission concur with the executive director on these matters.
All right. Is there any objection to unanimous concurrence of the executive director's determination? Seeing none, we concur.
That takes us to item six, which is the consent calendar for the San Diego Coast District. There's one application for temporary trailers to be installed at MiraCosta College in Encinitas to be used while they complete renovations to other campus facilities. There's been no correspondence and no opposition to this item, so staff recommends the commission approve the consent calendar.
Move to approve the consent calendar.
Is there any objection to unanimous consent? Seeing none, we approve the consent calendar.
All right, great. Next item seven is the deputy director's report for the South Coast District, Orange County. There's three waivers being reported, one for geologic testing in Newport Bay, and two for routine residential projects in Seal Beach. Again, there have been no comments or opposition on these items, so staff recommends the commission concur with the executive director's determination and approve all items on the deputy director's report.
Any objection to unanimous concurrence? Seeing none, we concur.
Item eight is for consent calendar items moved, regular calendar items being moved to consent, which there are none today. So that takes us to item 9A, which is the City of Huntington Beach Local Coastal Program Amendment number 2-16 that requests to amend the implementation plan of the city's LCP. The proposed amendment makes six changes to the IP. One on changing the parkland in lieu fees and how they're calculated, making changes to the permitting process for wireless communication facilities. There's a new senior residential overlay district to apply to specific mobile homes, but currently there are no mobile home parks in the coastal zone where this overlay would be applied. There's a prohibition on medical marijuana dispensaries in the city, some minor changes to the sign ordinance, and some other reorganization and clarification. But none of these items are raising concerns with staff, and staff's recommending approval as submitted. And there's been no comments in opposition on this item, so staff recommends the commission approve the matter as submitted.
Thank you. Any ex partes on this? Seeing none, do we have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move that the commission reject the City of Huntington Beach Implementation Program Amendment number 2-16 as submitted, and I'm asking for a no vote.
Second.
Do you care to speak to your motions?
No. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Is there any, is there one motion or two?
Just one.
Okay. Is there any objection to unanimous no vote? Seeing no objection, we the motion is passed. No, I'm sorry.
To approve as submitted.
You know what I mean.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam
we
Chair.
We certified the implementation program amendment as submitted, right? Yeah.
That's right.
Okay, I was just looking for it in the little sentence, but there we go. Okay.
All right, that takes us to 9B, which is a request to extend the 90-day time limit for commission action on Dana Point LCP Amendment 1-17, which is to modify the city's procedures on accessory dwelling units and junior accessory dwelling units to comply with changes to state law. Of course, staff is intending to bring that matter back as soon as possible, but we are requesting the full one-year extension on it.
Do we have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move that the commission extend the time limit to act on the City of Dana Point Local Coastal Program Amendment number 1-17 for a period of 1 year, and I'm asking for an aye vote.
Anyone want to speak to your motions? Okay.
We have a unanimous yes vote, and therefore the motion passes.
Thank you. Item 10A was postponed, so that takes us to 11A, which is a new appeal filed by Sharon Fudge of a permit granted by the City of Laguna Beach to DP Reynolds Corporation, Harl and Olvera for construction of a 50-foot-long retaining wall on the seaward side of an oceanfront single-family home at 31101 South Coast Highway in Laguna Beach. The appellants raise a number of concerns with the proposal, some of which commission staff determined would raise a substantial issue as to conformity with the LCP. For instance, the city's action did not determine whether certain policies that prohibit many types of development on bluff faces would apply to the proposed development. The appellant also has challenged the purpose of the retaining wall, which has a deepened foundation system and tieback system, that it'll function as a shoreline protective device. And in that circumstance, the LCP has a number of requirements that the applicant demonstrate there's a need and an imminent threat to the house, and that hasn't occurred in this case. So staff's recommending the commission determine that a substantial issue exists with respect to the grounds on which the appeal has been filed, and unless three or more commissioners want to hold a hearing on that question, substantial issue will be found, and the matter will come back on de novo at a later date.
Are there any ex partes on this matter? So I'm sorry, Carl, I was distracted. Are you saying there is substantial issue?
You'd yes, like staff's to have a recommending hearing? Substantial okay, issues. So if three commissioners okay, are you. Interested in a hearing.
I understand. No, I do. So do three or more commissioners wish to find no substantial issue? Seeing none, substantial issue is...
It's found in...
Found. And we'll have a hearing at a later date?
That's correct.
And then do the applicants or anyone get to talk?
No, not
I do
at
have
this point.
Points. Okay, thank yeah. you.
All right, item 11B was postponed, which takes us to item 12A. There's a staff PowerPoint item on this, and we did receive some correspondence on this today at the hearing room. I'm not sure if that was distributed or not, but there's no staff addendum. This is application 517607. This is item 12A. By Roger Worthington for complete demolition of an existing house, construction of a new one at 207 Calle Conchita in the city of San Clemente. If we can have slide two, please. The existing residence is located on a coastal canyon lot adjacent to Trafalgar Canyon, approximately 500 feet from the beach within the city of San Clemente. The site's currently developed with an approximately 2,700 square foot two-level single-family home with a varying height of 10 to 19 feet above natural grade. Slide three. The proposed house would be a 25-foot high, 5,640 square foot two-story house over a partial basement, so a total of three levels, with a two-car garage, decks, spa, patio, and landscape improvements. Next slide. The applicant's rear property line extends into the canyon. In this case, the canyon slope is predominantly occupied by native vegetation, particularly by lemonade berry scrub. Lemonade berry scrub is a coastal scrub that's vulnerable and at risk to extinction due to its restricted range and relatively few populations. In addition, Dr. Engel, our senior ecologist, has determined that the lemonade berry scrub occupying the canyon does rise to the level of ESHA and must be protected, consistent with Section 30240 of the Coastal Act. The proposed single-family home will be constructed on an area of the lot already developed and will not encroach into the canyon or impact the coastal canyon slope. The proposed residence will be set back further landward than the existing residence and will conform to the setback requirements outlined in the city's certified land use plan. The proposed residence shown by the green shape on this slide and the caisson supporting shoring system will both meet the minimum 15-foot setback from the canyon edge and from the line of native vegetation and will not encroach into the canyon. Ancillary improvements such as the patios and walls also meet the minimum 5-foot setback for top of coastal canyon setbacks. The residence is not anticipated to have direct impacts to sensitive habitat. However, given the residence's proximity to the canyon and that there is the potential for brush fires, fuel modification is required by the Orange County Fire Authority for the approved project. The required fuel modification has the potential to impact ESHA, but it should be noted that this lot was subdivided and developed before the Coastal Act's adoption in 1977. Thus, the habitat protection policies must be applied based on the pre-existing development layout. The project site and surrounding properties are already subject to fuel modification requirements. And because fuel mods already required at the site along the canyon slope to protect the existing neighboring residences, the proposal by the applicant will not increase the potential impact to ESHA resulting from fuel modification. In fact, the setback from the laminate berry is larger than the existing condition, which is shown by the purple shape. That's the existing house, which is closer to the canyon edge in the habitat than the proposed house. In addition, according to the Fire Authority's vegetation management guideline, the lemonade berry and some other native species like toyon are deemed acceptable in all fuel modification, wet and dry zones. These native plant species are considered fire resistant. So clearance of the vegetation alliance is not necessary based on the Fire Authority's fuel mod guidelines and are deemed acceptable to exist in the fuel mod areas. But to ensure the impacts to ESHA are minimized, staff's recommending condition 8, which requests the applicant submit a revised fuel mod plan that identifies the lemonade berry habitat and notes that the area is supposed to remain unimpacted. Condition 8 also requires that any thinning or removal of plants occur by hand cutting, and condition 9 requires a biologist monitor during any fuel mod work. Slide 5, please. Regarding community character, the project is located within an existing developed urban residential area and is compatible with the character and scale of the surrounding area. Site surrounded by multi-story single-family homes. In addition, the residence will be consistent with the line of development along the rim of the canyon. As for hazards, based on the geotechnical information provided by the applicant, the proposed development will be safe for the anticipated life of the structure. So as conditioned, the proposed project is consistent with the habitat protection hazards and visual resource protection policies of the Coastal Act, and staff's recommending the item be approved with conditions, and we understand the applicant's in agreement with that. That concludes our comments.
Thank you. I have no speaker cards on this. Are there any ex partes? Seeing none, do we have a motion?
I move the Commission approve Coastal Development Permit Application 5170607 in accordance with the staff recommendation and recommend a yes vote.
Second. You care to speak to your motion?
No.
Okay. Do you second? The makers of the motion are asking for a yes vote. Any objection to unanimous yes vote? Seeing none, the motion passes.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. That takes us to item 12B, which is by Edie Miller, and is demolition of a 1,900-square-foot two-story duplex with a two-car garage and carport and construction of a 3,100-square-foot two-story, 24-foot-high single-family residence with an attached two-car garage. And I think on the prior item I mentioned that we'd received a letter today, but that was actually for this item, so I apologize for that. Slide 2, please. The project site is a beach-fronting lot located within an existing urban residential area at 1017 Seal Way, which is down coast of the Seal Beach Pier in the city of Seal Beach. There's a paved public walkway between the beach and the subject site, and the lot is zoned residential high density. Next slide, please. The proposed homes designed similar to other development in the area of Seal Beach. House would be, again, 3,100 square feet, two stories, and with a two-car garage. Slide four. This is a photograph of the site showing the existing residences to the west, and the Seal Beach Pier is off the slide to the left. Next slide, please. Slide five is a photograph of the residences to the east with a subject site just off the left-hand side of this photograph. Slide six, please. The proposed project involves the replacement of an existing duplex, which is legal nonconforming, with a single-family residence that would be conforming. We're highlighting the change in the number of units at this site, as there was some concern expressed at last month's hearing over a similar project in Hermosa Beach, which has a development pattern similar to Seal Beach. This subject site is designated residential high density in the city zoning code, which allows a maximum of one residence per 2,178 square feet of lot area. So in order to replace the duplex with a similar one, the lot would need to be at least 4,356 square feet. And in this case, the proposed lot, or the subject lot, is 3,373 square feet. So that means only one residential unit may be built on the property by the city's zoning regulations. And while the zoning code's not the standard of review for the commission, the proposed project is consistent with past commission actions in the area. There have been a number of projects like this. The city's housing element states that the city of Seal Beach examines any coastal zone development that entails demolition or conversion of residential units that aren't categorically exempt from CEQA for conformity with the Mellow Act, which is the statewide law that requires preserving housing for persons and families with low and moderate incomes in the coastal zone. The City of Seal Beach analyzed the project for compliance with Mellow Act, concluded that neither the existing units in the duplex was an affordable unit. And while the existing units aren't considered affordable, and the subject lot's too small to provide a second unit, the site is located in a densely filled residential area where many residential opportunities and amenities exist, restaurants, grocery stores, et cetera. And the public beach is, of course, in front of the residence. Therefore, the project is located in an area that can accommodate it and is will not have cumulative adverse impacts to coastal resources located within these areas, and it will minimize vehicle miles traveled and energy consumption. Slide seven. So the major issues by the project concern beachfront development that could be affected by waves, erosion, storm conditions, sea level rise, or other natural hazards. And in addition, it raises the typical water quality concerns. As I mentioned, we did get one letter today from Matthew and Jennifer Walker. These are neighbors to the project site, raising objections over the height of the project and stating that the height resulting from conformance with the floodplain regulations will have impacts on ambient light and viewscape. Based on the plans attached to the staff report, the street grade here is at 12.4 feet, and the finished floor elevation, which is the height to which floodplain conformance is tied, is at 12.5 feet. So conformance here with the flood regs doesn't appear to be adding much to the height of the residence, and we think the project's in conformance with the appearance of other residences there in the area. So staff's recommending approval of the project with six special conditions typical for this area, and the motions and resolutions are on page 5 of the staff report.
That
all right,
staff.
Thank you very much. Are there any ex partes? Seeing none, I have one speaker slip here, Ronald Wickstrom, but he's here for questions, apparently. Would you care to speak on the matter or just answer questions?
I'm just here to answer any questions that you have. I'm the designer of the project.
Okay, thank you.
Agent for the owner.
Thank you. I bring it back to the commission. Commissioner Brownsey.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't object to the project. I think the conditions are good. This is just an ongoing concern that I have. I was pleased to see the setback on the first floor, but it always makes me a little queasy when the structure goes right up to the line of the public walkway, because I think it crowds out the public access. And I can see from the photos that in that neighborhood, that is the pattern of development. But I do believe that, you know, I just want to signal that I feel that there should be a little more concern expressed by development that goes right to public access ways or right to the beach, because I do think that it impacts public access, simply because I think a lot of the public, just human nature being what it is, you know, aren't going to want to walk close to these structures because they don't live there. They kind of think they're private, so they're going to walk around them. And I'm not asking that this project be halted or modified. I just want to make that public statement with respect to setbacks, which I think are very important. So I want to compliment the property owner and the designer for the first floor setback, but, you know, just making that idea clear. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Brownsey. Staff absolutely shares your concerns about those issues. You know, this particular project, you know, the living space components, they are actually set back and have at least a 5-foot setback, I believe. What you're seeing there on the plans is actually the accessory development, the patios that are coming up against the walkway. I'm sorry?
It was the second floor balcony that went to the walkway.
Right, it's a balcony.
Okay.
That's correct. But this is the pattern of development in this area. But we are going to be seeing a couple projects like this coming up on the agenda in the next few months, where we do have a very significant concern with the setback that's being proposed in that case, which isn't in this part of Seal Beach. It's in down coast about a mile in the Sunset Beach community.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do I have a motion?
Application number 517-0773, Miller Seal Beach. Move approval.
Second.
And would you care to speak to your motion?
No.
Your second? The makers of the motion are asking for a yes vote. Is there any objection to a unanimous yes vote? Seeing none, the motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That takes us to item 13, which is the Deputy Director's Report for the San Diego Coast District. There's one immaterial amendment and one emergency CDP being reported. The emergency CDP is to dredge the mouth of Los Penasquitos Lagoon at Torrey Pines State Beach to enhance the outflow of Los Penasquitos Lagoon. The excavated materials were placed on the adjacent beach. And in December, the commission had approved a CDP for this work, but the applicant's still working on some condition compliance monitoring issues. But the situation arose and the applicant needed to address that, so we granted an emergency permit to allow them to proceed with that work. But there's been no opposition on any of these items, so staff's recommending the concurrence with the executive director and approval of the director's report.
Any objection to a unanimous concurrence of the deputy director's report? Seeing no objection, we concur.
All right, there's no items being moved under item 14. Item 15A was postponed, which takes us to item 15B. And there is a staff PowerPoint on this item. 15B is a request from the City of Carlsbad to amend the zoning ordinance portion of the city's IP. Slide 2, please. The city proposes text changes to add auto repairs and allowed use within the planned industrial zone, subject to approval of a minor conditional use permit from the city planner. The proposed amendment would also change the permit required for auto storage uses in the heavy commercial limited industrial zone and planned industrial zones from a conditional use permit approved by the Planning Commission to a minor conditional use permit by the city planner. And finally, the amendment request establishes development standards requiring auto repair and auto storage uses to be screened from public view with landscaping or fencing. Slide 3. The amendment would expand the areas where auto repair uses are permitted to include the PM zone. The blue line on the map shows the coastal zone boundary. And the areas shaded pink are the zones where the auto repair uses are already allowed within the city. The areas shaded green are the PM or planned industrial zones where the auto repair uses would be allowed. Most of the area zoned for PM within the coastal zone where auto repair uses would now be allowed are located near areas where auto repair is already permitted. And finally, the gray shaded areas are zoned PM, but existing specific plans preclude development of auto repair uses in those locations. Slide 4. The amendment would also simplify the approval process for auto storage uses by changing the permit required from Planning Commission approval to a conditional use permit approved by the city planner for a minor conditional use permit. The minor permit requirements designed to ensure that auto repair and auto storage uses are sited in appropriate locations within the city and that potential impacts are avoided or mitigated. Slide 5. So staff recommends approval of the city's amendment as submitted, and the resolutions to achieve that are on page 3 of the staff report.
Okay, any ex partes? Seeing none, I have no speaker slips, so what's the will of the commission?
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
I move the commission reject the implementation program amendment for the City of Carlsbad LCP 6CAR17823 as submitted and ask for a no vote.
To speak to your motion?
No, Madam Chair.
Thank you. The makers of the motion are asking for a no vote. Is there any unwillingness for unanimous no vote? Seeing no unwillingness, the certification, the implementation program amendment is certified as submitted.
Thank you. That takes us to item 16A, and there's a staff PowerPoint on this. Item 16A is a notice of impending development submitted by Caltrans to remove non-native vegetation, install temporary irrigation, and plant native vegetation at the Batiquitos Bluffs mitigation site in the cities of Encinitas and Carlsbad. Slide 2, please. The 50-acre Batiquitos Bluffs mitigation site is located approximately 400 feet west of El Camino Real on either side of La Costa Avenue, as shown on this slide. The site's approximately 2 miles inland of the ocean and 1,000 feet south of Batiquitos Lagoon. It's surrounded primarily by open space with residential development adjacent to the southeast corner of the site. Slide 3. Batiquitos Bluffs is one of the mitigation sites included in and authorized by the North Coast Corridor Public Works Plan and Transportation and Resource Enhancement Program, or the PWP, which the Commission certified in 2014. The PWP is a 40-year plan that includes widening Interstate 5 to accommodate HOV lanes, double-tracking the rail corridor, constructing new bike and pedestrian trails, and restoring sensitive habitat in northern San Diego County. Through the provisions of the PWP's Resource Enhancement and Mitigation Program, preservation of the Batiquitos Bluff site will mitigate long-term temporary impacts to upland habitat associated with transportation projects authorized in the PWP, including Phase 1, Stages 2 and 3 of the Interstate 5 project approved by the Commission last month. Pursuant to the program, disturbances to habitat resulting in impacts lasting more than 12 months are defined as long-term temporary impacts. Such impacts may be mitigated with preservation of high-quality native habitat under the threat of development at a 2-to-1 ratio of preservation to impacts. So preservation of 41.4 acres of high-quality upland habitat at the subject site will mitigate long-term temporary impacts associated with the transportation projects, which is consistent with the plan. Slide 4. About 3.9 acres of disturbed upland habitat, including eucalyptus woodland, non-native grassland, and backer scrub, will be restored to coastal sage scrub with native grasses in the area shown on this slide. Specific tasks include raking to remove thatch, exotic species removal, weeding, spot spraying, hand seeding, and trash removal, but there's no grading proposed. Slide 5. So the 3.9-acre mitigation area is within the larger Batiquitos Bluffs mitigation site, which contains an additional 41.4 acres of high-quality habitat. Caltrans will permanently retire development potential of the site, preserving existing high-quality habitat in perpetuity. Restoration and preservation of the site will protect chaparral and coastal sage scrub and support sensitive plants and wildlife. So restoration of the site will also improve the connection of wetlands to uplands and improve wildlife connectivity between the open space areas. Slide 6. So subject projects been designated are designed to be consistent with the certified PWP, which is the standard of review for the NOID. The staff's recommending the Commission determine the development described in the notice of impending development is consistent with the certified public works plan. And the motion and resolution are on page 6 of the staff report.
All right, thank you. I have no ex partes. I have no do I have any ex partes? No, I don't. I was right. No speaker slips. Do I have a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move for consistency determination for NCC NOID 00418 as submitted and ask for a yes vote.
Second. Would you like to speak to your motion?
Oh, Madam Chair.
Do you second? No. Okay. The makers of the motion are asking for a yes vote. Any unwillingness for a unanimous yes vote? Seeing no unwillingness, the motion passes.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Item 17A was postponed, so that concludes the San Diego agenda and the agenda for the day.
Thank
That's
you.
That's right. And we'll be seeing you in San Diego.
San Diego.
And anticipate longer days.
A longer day.
There will be a reckoning for all these postponements.
There will be a reckoning.
A reckoning. Oh. All right, we're adjourned.